Post-colonial Europe, looking at European identities from a different perspective. A podcast.
What does a man look for in a place to live and do his work? This is the Valley of the Credit, with its river that rises in the ancient slate hills to the north and winds its way to Lake Ontario. It attracted its first settlers more than a century and a half ago. And since then, the land has grown and prospered. The town of Mississauga, in the busy heart of Canada, a land on the moon.
Welcome to a podcast about Canadian tree history.
The city of Mississauga borders Toronto and Lake Ontario. It is roughly the same size as Liechtenstein, with a population of 830,000 as of 2017. Mississauga is the sixth most populated city in Canada. The city was established in 1974 as a result of villages merging. The Credit River flows right through the city, emptying in Lake Ontario. This lends to its name, which comes from an Anishinaabe word, meaning those at the Great River Mouth. But where does the name come from? The Mississauga of the Credit First Nation, though most of the people aren't aware of this. The Mississauga of the Credit are an Indigenous community from Canada, one of the six groups part of the Mississauga Nation. Today, they inhabit 25 square kilometers in the southwest portion of the Six Nation Reserve near Hagersville, Ontario. But their legally recognized territory is not what it once was.
Ask a stranger.
Do you know what the name of the Indigenous group in Mississauga, Toronto area is?
I didn't even know that we had an official one.
I think they are the Mississaugas of the Ojibwe.
Not off the top of my head.
So they're the Mississauga of the Credit. So what do you know about treaties?
The only treaty I know is some of the original treaties, but I don't know much else than that.
I remember talking about Indigenous history quite frequently, actually, in elementary school, but it never dove into the harsh realities that actually occurred.
I know that in Ontario, there were quite a few treaties signed, but I wouldn't say that many of those treaties were followed. There's not peaceful coexistence.
Would you be surprised to hear that Mississauga and Toronto, basically all of the GTA, is on treaty land?
All of it?
That's very surprising. It's weird that I've never heard of that before.
I remember talking about that during the history classes in elementary school and such, but it was never in very much detail. Europeans just came and set up shop, right?
I had no idea that all of the land, the high school that I went to, the morning announcements, they'd always acknowledge that we have to thank the Indigenous because we are on Indigenous land. But yeah, I had no idea that all of the land, when they would bring it up, they'd say specifics like the land our school is on.
What do you know about the Credit River and the Etobicoke Creek?
I've definitely been fishing or just like walking alongside it. Every time I go there, there's like people.
I have gone kayaking in the Credit River. I know a fair few people from school that have gone fishing, at least in the Credit.
How would you react to hearing that the Mississauga of the Credit actually have exclusive fishing rights on the Credit River and the Etobicoke Creek?
I don't think I've ever heard somebody talking about that even.
That's insane.
That's very surprising.
Oh, wow. That's really surprising, actually. I didn't know about that.
Do you think you would fish on the Credit River or the Etobicoke Creek after knowing this?
No, I definitely wouldn't.
You know, definitely not.
Now, you might be wondering what's going on. Either you're familiar with Mississauga as a city, but not so much with the people, or you've just heard both for the first time and are having trouble keeping things straight. We'll sort this out now. We're Kaylee Chambers,
Esther Kellner,
and Antonia Plankhouse.
Three students from the University College Freiburg in Germany. I grew up in the city Mississauga, and Esther and Antonia were kind enough to put their time and hard work into something they had little connection with. After the research we made, we all felt more connected to the Mississauga than we did before. In this podcast, we are going to take a closer look at the shady, discriminatory, and shameful business of the treaties that have been made with the Mississauga of the Credit First Nation. Treaties, and the land that was bought in them, form the basis of all Canadian society today. They are legal documents that are valid, and yet they are ignored, obscured, and forgotten. We'll present to you a comprehensive timeline of the treaties the Mississauga were coerced into. We'll explain how this is not just history, but promises we all must keep every day. We are all treaty people, and we hope this can be a starting point in having all Greater Toronto Area residents honor the treaty lands they are on.
The colonization background.
Canadian history is more complex than what is taught in schools and is more sinister than its international image would suggest. First modern European contact was made in 1497, when the British made their claim to North American land. The French also came, trying to stake their claim into the New World. They came into a world with thriving indigenous nations, all with their very different cultures, lifestyles, and practices. Our point of departure is here. The defeat of the British in the American Revolution caused a flood of loyalist refugees to the remaining British colonies, mainly to modern-day Ontario. To reward the loyalists, the British gave parcels of fertile lakefront land to the fleeing American loyalists. Where did this land come from, though? The Mississauga of the Credit, of course. The British wanted safety and thought that if the land was bought, then there would be no retaliation. Therefore, the treaties made with the Mississauga of the Credit and any First Nation were all technically paid. Though, we'll see that it is not as straightforward as it seems. Time went by and the British colonies decided to form into a confederation. And so, the beginnings of modern-day Canada were formed in 1867, of course without inviting Indigenous nations to join.
The treaties.
We've just given you a small introduction to Canadian colonial history. Just like in school, we painted over the rich history of Indigenous people. What we're about to do is to take a deep dive into the treaties that Mississauga were coerced into making and what was at stake at both ends of the table. It is a shame that this podcast can only focus on such a negative part of the Mississauga history, but we do this to confront the history we ignore, understanding that through this we can begin to see the resilience and beauty of the Mississauga culture. The chief of the Mississauga of the Credit, Stace Lafond, has graciously given his time to our podcast. His voice will be interspersed with ours, helping to explain Mississauga history.
So I'll just introduce myself and my language, Anishinaabe, who I am, where I'm from, what my Anishinaabe name is, which roughly translates to Leech People Man. And my clan is Wolf or Turtle, depending on my lineage, either on my mother or my father's side.
It is difficult to find information on treaties. Even with digitized historical documents, treaties are called differently depending on the source, or sometimes multiple treaties have the same name. And to make matters worse, important facts were not recorded at all.
And I'll tell you that when you negotiate things, I can just imagine how hard it was for my ancestors, because even today, when I sit at a table talking about these are my lands, these are my waters, that contradicts my value system. Because I think of the land as Mother Earth. I think of the water as a living spirit. How can I own something like that?
Despite this, we have tried to make a coherent timeline for you, mentioning all treaties, but simplifying the difficulties we encountered. What follows is the treaty's history of the Mississauga of the Credit.
So I have the Mississauga at Niagara of 1781. Then I have the Between the Lake Purchase of 1792. And then I have the Brant Tracts in 97. The Toronto Purchase was, 1805 for one of them. I mean, as you know, it was a long drawn out process there. The head of the Lake Purchase I have is 1806. And the adjacent purchase, as they call it, a treaty or purchase, 1818, Treaty 22, 1820, and Treaty 23, 1820.
The first purchase from the Mississauga of the Credit First Nation took place in 1781. As we mentioned earlier, this purchase was to make way for American settlers. This is the Mississauga Cession at Niagara and makes up most of the land at the U.S.-Canadian border by Niagara Falls. Until 1795, three more purchases took place, all to gain settlement land for different parties arriving in the Toronto area. The three next treaties from here are the most impactful ones, and the ones we'll be discussing at length. Let's talk about the 1787 Johnson-Butler Purchase.
You call it the Gunshot Treaty, probably.
The Canadian government and Mississauga met at the Bay of Quinte near Kingston on the northern shore of Lake Ontario. In question was the land originating from the shore up until the place one could hear a gunshot from. hence the unofficial name of the Gunshot Treaty. Presents given to the Mississauga of the Credit were retroactively called payment for the land. And just like that, the Gunshot Treaty was formalized.
It was a blank deed with chief's symbols wafered onto the page, and that's how it began.
This seems sketchy at best and depraved at worst. Things get very interesting here, but also confusing, so please stick with us.
The legal basis for all Canadian settlement in Toronto thus far was essentially an arts and crafts project. To rectify this, another treaty was made, this time one that is more legally binding.
So obviously Canada says, well, this looks to be a problem here, let's go back and negotiate.
This treaty was called Treaty 13, or
the Toronto Purchase,
signed in August of 1805.
And so they went back, and the First Nations perspective was, well, most of our chiefs have passed on. And you have to remember the relationship with the Crown back then, right? So it was like, you know, great father, we'll have to take your word on what was done, you know, and how it was unfolded. But we thought that they only were going to take this much land. Anyway, so those are like the conversations they had with Canada. Very much, we rely on your goodwill, very paternalistic. A little bit hard to read from today's perspective when you go back and look at your ancestors and see how they interacted with the government of the time.
The Toronto Purchase, intended to only make legal what the Gunshot Treaty set up, now had the legal rights to more land than the Gunshot Treaty ever agreed upon. The British purchased around 1,011 square kilometers of land for the sum of just 10 shillings, equal to 25 euro or 40 Canadian dollars today. And it was not just money promised here, but also the exclusive right of the Mississauga of the Credit First Nation to fish in the Etobicoke Creek. For non-locals, this might seem trivial. However, the Etobicoke Creek is a huge part of Mississauga and Toronto life. Everyone grew up fishing here, grew up playing here. There are parks, train stations, apartment buildings here. The little that is accessible is beloved. The rest should be better taken care of.
Later, in 1805, the second Toronto Purchase, officially called Treaty 13A, was made. This was a preliminary treaty for the Head of the Lake Treaty that we'll explain in a second. This is a common theme here with treaties, at least in this area. The first document is made, then one comes along a few years later to make it more legally sound. We can see that these treaties are based on very inaccurate information and are made with little care or compensation for the Mississauga involved. And remember, these form the basis of Canadian settlement law and life. The Head of the Lake Purchase, or the Treaty 14, came a year later in 1806. The British bought a strip of 30 kilometers of land on the shore of Lake Ontario, with a width of 10 kilometers inland. For locals, this is about the whole of the Greater Toronto Area along the lake, up to Highway 401. Think of how expensive houses are here today. One house can cost around $1 million Canadian, or about 700,000 euros. And yet this land was bought for 160 Canadian dollars, or about 100 euro.
So that one was very clear. In my mind, there was no meeting of minds. You can't even pretend there was no meeting of minds. It was simply outright manipulation and theft.
But again, it wasn't just money. Just like how Treaty 13 gave the Mississauga the exclusive right to fish along Etobicoke Creek, Treaty 14 gave the Mississauga the exclusive fishing rights for the Credit River. The same Credit River that the canoe and kayak clubs are on today. The same Credit River that people fish on all the time. And the same Credit River that the Port Credit Park borders on. Stereotypical markers of the Canadian life are all along the Credit River, while we ignore the fishing rights the Mississauga have here. Remember these fishing rights for later, but for now we continue on to the situation of the Mississauga in 1806. Through these treaties, where land was unintentionally given up, the Mississauga way of life became less and less viable. Diseases were brought to Canada by settlers. There was ongoing war. Starting with the fur trade, Indigenous life became dependent on European money. However, without access to good land, which the new European economy was based off of, there was no way to make money. That is why in 1818 and 1820, three more treaties were drawn up.
A Jacobs Purchase, as they call it, in 1818. Treaty 22 and 23 were taken on the same day, or very close to it anyway, same year at least.
The Mississauga of the Credit surrendered all remaining land except a small area. This was necessary cash grab to keep people and the Mississauga tribe alive.
It's interesting that those treaties, in my mind, are still lands held by the Mississaugas. I mean, you're talking about Burlington, Oakville, Mississauga City, those type of areas.
last treaty we want to mention is the William Treaty, taken into effect in 1923. Yes, 1923, after the First World War, when William Lyon Mackenzie King was Prime Minister, when Lucy Maud Montgomery was alive and writing Anne of Green Gables. Three separate and large parcels of land, all the land in southern Ontario that had not been ceded up to this point, was sold off. This land was valued at over 30 million Canadian dollars at the time, but the government paid only 500. This treaty was negotiated with other groups in the Mississauga Nation. However, the Mississauga of the Credit were not invited to negotiate for this treaty, and were unaware that their land was even being negotiated with. So that leaves us with where we are today. The Mississauga were pushed onto their current reservation, near Brantford, left with none of their heritage land near the lake. They have fishing rights on the Etobicoke Creek and the Credit River, and yet, this is ignored.
The Settlement.
Now that we know Mississauga history, we can talk about things today. It is indeed a very harrowing past, and one that was at the hand of our ancestors. However, things haven't stopped happening since then. History never stands still, especially not treaty and Indigenous history, which passes every day ignored. What we want to explain next is a land settlement. You might have heard about it, because at the time it was the single largest land claim settlement in Canada. But if you haven't, that's totally fine. That's why we're here. In 1986, the Mississauga of the Credit made a claim to the Canadian government that the Toronto Purchase, that's Treaty 13, that replaced the Gunshot Purchase, didn't compensate their tribe enough. That was the one that only paid 40 Canadian dollars and 25 euros, because the original signatories were dead, and none told the Mississauga of the Credit the real value or extent of the land in question. With no official record of how much land was really supposed to be purchased with the Gunshot Treaty, the Toronto Purchase ended up being a much bigger grab of land than expected, for much less money than that was fair.
My people, ancestors, were of the understanding that the government was going to take care of that land for us, to have it forever so that whenever we came back from our travels, this land would always be ours and that they would never sell it. Well, as soon as we moved, they sold it.
In 2002, the Mississauga's land claim was accepted.
So we have a legal opinion from Sir John A. Macdonald of the day, talking to Canada, or the government of the day, and saying, you've just taken the first in-kind trust with the First Nation. Every penny that you spend, you have to account for.
In 2010, the Canadian government and the Mississauga of the Credit First Nation came to an agreement. They agreed that the circumstances of the Toronto Purchase constituted a breach of lawful obligations. The land would not be returned to the Mississauga, but they would receive 145 million Canadian dollars, or about 100 million euros, based on historical land evaluation.
So this is what's really important here. We should always recognize treaties, but for anyone who is doubtful before, this is your legal proof. By agreeing to settle with the Mississauga, the Canadian government affirmed the legal usage of treaties in modern law. When the Mississauga of the Credit sold their land to the British, cities could develop. Cities like Mississauga, Toronto, Hamilton, Oakville. These are all based off of these legal treaty documents. Settler Canadians need these as their claim to the land. And if we can pay Indigenous groups to keep them legally sound, then these treaties are clearly and obviously legally binding documents today. But like we said before, they aren't just all about money. Remember the fishing rights you mentioned? If treaties are legal documents, then all parts of treaties are legal documents. As agreed upon in the Toronto Purchase, Treaty 13A, and the Head of the Lake Purchase, fishing rights on the Etobicoke Creek and the Credit River are exclusive to the Mississauga of the Credit.
I would like to see those recognized today. I would like to actually begin those conversations with the proper people to start, you know, building relationships in that area and use the treaties to make that relationship happen, you know, assert some jurisdiction in that area.
The treaties in the Greater Toronto Area have also included provisions to hunt and fish in other areas. Some have negotiations on fair use of water in other ways besides just fishing. Importantly, there was also an obligation for settlers to take care of the environment. But I can tell you, this is not being respected, discussed, or even acknowledged by the settler Canadian government. This is simply an unknown fact. Now we can understand why so many people in the city of Mississauga simply know nothing about treaty rights and the Mississauga of the Credit First Nation. None of what we've talked about is taught in schools. explained on the news, taught ever. But we think it should be known, don't you?
Conclusion.
What do you think you would do if you lived in Mississauga? What will you do if you do live in Mississauga? Respecting treaty rights is one thing. Educating others is another. Chief Lafond has told us the most important thing settlers can do is really listen to Indigenous groups and stand with them. We are all treaty people. Treaties aren't just special right-giving documents for Indigenous people. They're grim documents based on coercion that outline what both parties need to do. We need to pay. We need to not fish. The Mississauga were forced to share their land, and they want you to know that they're fine with sharing as long as we do our part.
You know, keep in mind that the Mississaugas are not necessarily the type of people that would ever say, get off my land, I want it back. They would say, in Canada, you stole this from us, you owe us for it. We want other land, we want money, but we're not asking you to kick anybody off the land. You know, that's certainly not who I am as a leader, and I don't believe it's the way of my people.
The Mississauga of the Credit have shown incredible resilience and kindness in the face of the tragedy and genocide that has characterized so much of Canadian history. Chief Lafond says treaties are always supposed to be read in favor of Indigenous groups, and he's right. The least we can do as settlers is let the Mississauga of the Credit fish, exclusively.
I'll read it to you, and it's called Mother. Why do you hurt me when I have nothing but love for you? I have seen you crawl from the dark into the light. I have watched you learn to walk and then to fly. I have seen you squabble and fight. I have cheered for you, and I have feared for you. I give freely of what is mine to give, yet you take more than I am able. You hurt me more and more. You ignore my pain and my cries. I am ancient, but I am not immortal. I have a time. Why do you seek to rob me of it? Through the years I have been here for you and yours, for your grandmothers and their grandmothers and their grandmothers. I would stay to see your children, raise their children, but I cannot, for I am dying. I do not measure the passing of time as you do. Nevertheless, my time is coming, and it is soon. I love you, my children, but I fear I will fail you. And even though you have failed me first, anger is not in me, for I was created of love, as were you. Therefore, the toughest part of goodbye is knowing that you cannot go on without me, that your time will end far too soon, and no one will know. This great journey, this grand adventure called humanity, will be undone as if it never existed. I will care for you as long as I am able. Yet when the rivers no longer flow, when the trees die, when the wind rages and the storms come, know that it is not my anger. It is the end of the love I can no longer give, the love you can no longer take. It is my end, and sadly, it is yours.